You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Folks, Mother's Day is around the corner, and let me talk to you about 1-800-Flowers. I can't wait. Every year, it's a tradition. I send stuff to my mother, my mother-in-law, and my wife because they are three amazing moms. They're better than all your moms out there. You think you have good moms? No, I have good moms in my life. I'm just kidding. This was a little harsh. I'm sure you guys all have good moms too. From your mom to the mother of your children and all the moms in between, this Mother's Day, give back to the ones that have given you everything. 1-800-Flowers helps you celebrate all amazing moms, from homemade bouquets, sweet treats, gourmet food, and one-of-a-kind gifts, ordered easily and delivered fresh. For a limited time, you can save up to 40% off Mother's Day bestsellers at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan. Don't wait. Order today and save up to 40% at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Well, we left our homes up in Bristol Bay for the waters of Miami shore. With a hippo at the helm and our severance pay, we fly the pirate flag once more. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we get wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. Pirate radio. Well, the ship is a wreck, shit stains the deck as Michael Hollow's fellas make more. And Billy is a worry that he's got the scurvy, cause Chris ate all the limes in store. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we get wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. Pirate radio. Now Roy is a chum when he's on the rum, he's the glue when we spring a leak. And Stu is a mess, he does less and less, and Greg's sounding worse each week. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we get wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. Pirate radio. Someone yelled ahoy, who the hell's cabin boy? Somebody named Tony, who knows? Once we got the skip, well, I mean jump ship, cause he knew we would sail to gold. Pirate radio with the ship and crew, we got wind in our sails and the sky is blue. There's a devil up our nose, so much work to do. For the Pirate Radio.
Well, 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 David Sampson, the responsible David Sampson financial advisor. Look at you with all that egg on your face as GameStop and AMC are soaring yet again. If you took my financial advice, which was super serious, you'd be a thousandaire right now. You find the humor in this. We're soaring
the
back up to the moon.
That word. No, I've literally never heard that word before. That's just funny. That was a legitimate laugh. And I just finished Nothing Personal and I laughed at something I said, but it's way more fun to laugh at something you say.
So you're a financial expert. Yes. You know your way around.
No.
No? I thought you knew your way around the stock market. I know you have
That's
a law.
That's a Grand Canyon away from being an expert.
Okay. Well, you're a law. You've got a law background, right?
I am a trained lawyer. I was on Wall Street. I definitely know what to do, how to do it, but an expert?
Wait.
I would never have the hubris to use that word.
You were a lawyer that worked on Wall Street. So what exactly did you do before the Marlins? Before the Expos, actually.
I started off as a running my own company in Europe called News Travels Fast.
Yeah, I remember that. But you mentioned that you were a lawyer. I'm trying to get to like before
I went
that.
To law school, passed the bar. Okay. And didn't get the job I wanted, so started a business in Europe. The job I wanted in law was to be an assistant district attorney in Manhattan.
Oh.
And I did not get hired. I made it through 3 out of the 5 rounds and got rejected. And I was so pissed off because back in those days, Manhattan was the greatest DA's office in the country. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to work for Bronx or Brooklyn or Queens. I thought that I was a Manhattanite. It was like insulting to not work in Manhattan. So I said, fuck this. And I decided to start a business.
Which
greatest
was
the decision I ever made.
Yeah, it was.
It made my whole career. That decision made my career.
Did you end up selling that company? Yeah, right? You sold that newspaper company?
It just stopped. What were my assets? I bought papers every week and delivered them.
Oh, so you...
I literally just stopped.
Yeah, but you stopped with profits, yes?
The company made money. Absolutely. But the internet, it was not a long-term company. That company would never exist today.
So you saw the writing on the wall as to where the industry was going.
No, I was wrong about the writing on the wall because I assumed the internet wasn't real, but I met a guy on a plane from Morgan Stanley who said, listen, I love your business, but you're going to have a problem with this internet thing. And I said, no, I won't. He said, here's my card. Call if you ever do. And so I called him maybe 6 months later and he interviewed me and I got a job.
And that man was Jeffrey Loria.
That man was David Darst.
This is David Darst.
The guy at Morgan Stanley.
I know, but he hired you for Morgan Stanley?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I was the only non-MBA to be hired. Only JD in my whole class.
All right. Well, this whole thing started with me trying to explore your Wall Street background, and you looked at me like I was asking the wrong question, and here you are working for Morgan Stanley.
Yeah, I worked for Morgan Stanley for several years. I passed all the tests. I did derivatives, like derivative swaps for people, like collateralized derivatives, and traded and made money. And I did everything but cocaine and Margot Robbie. And it wasn't for lack of trying.
So you're feeling the FOMO right now as I'm soaring to the moon with my AMC stock, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling the FOMO of not buying Carnival at 14. And it's the same FOMO I feel in baseball when we trade a guy and the guy ends up being great, or we get a guy who we think is great and he ends up sucking. So
what's the greatest example of trading away a guy that ended up being great that you had as a prospect that you rated highly, but it wasn't working out and you thought you had to come to the realization that the ceiling isn't as high as you'd hoped, and then you pull the trigger and then, damn it, I was right all along on this person.
The greatest players we ever traded, we knew were going to be good and we were okay trading them. I mean, you have to go back to Adrian Gonzalez and you have to go back to Miggy. You have to go to players like that. But there were some players who we traded who ended up being serviceable. We didn't think Robert Andino would ever be a big leaguer. He played for us, but we thought he wouldn't be good, and he ended up actually.
What a shitty biggest mistake, right? Andino. Andino plays a little second base for the Orioles, and all of a sudden it's Samson's
big leaguer.
Greatest career.
Colin Moran. We didn't think Colin Moran would make it, and he made it. He plays for the Pirates now. Anyway, what's up, Dan?
Did every time that you guys called up Chris Aguila, were you guys like, this guy's no good?
Yes.
All right, good.
Who else did you do that with? You never did that with Volstead. Did you do that like 10 times with Volstead at the end?
You have no idea. The Chris Volstead story is really something.
Tell us it.
It's just not being willing. I mean, we're not doing this for the show, but he...
we're not? Wait, we've been doing show this entire time.
Is this the show?
Yes. I thought we were doing the show. Yes, please continue.
I already told Chris to bleep out your F-bombs.
Please continue.
Yeah, we've been doing
the
show.
By the way, that is a violation.
No, it is not.
This is supposed to be...
Apologize to Chris Aguila.
Because you always say, hey... Yeah, all right, we're going to start now. Ready? You do this, 3, 2, 1. Yeah.
We always also say that you're relentlessly authentic, so it's good for people to catch you in your unguarded...
By the way, there's no difference.
That's
there's
correct.
No difference.
Well, it's good for people
there's
to
no
see that.
There's no difference other than if you did that to another guest, I'm not sure that
I would
be
never. I would never dream of doing that to another guest.
We respect all our other guests way too much to ever imagine? Do something like that to them.
So I apologize
Mike,
to you.
Too much.
You've burned your bridges with Robert Andino and Chris Aguila. I'm very sorry.
Who else? Give us some more names.
I don't care. I mean, listen.
It sounded like you were headed into a Volstead bridge burning.
Here's the thing about players. We would call them 4A players. And a successful organization would not have 4A players on their team. A 4A player is too good to be in AAA and not good enough to be in the big leagues. And that's the reality of what happened.
The Aguila zone.
It's the Aguila. By the way, it's the Miguel Tejada zone. It's the Chris Aguila zone. It's the Chris Volstead zone. But Chris Voss said
Miguel Tejada.
There had to be a different Tejada.
A different Miguel. What Tejada?
Miguel Tejera.
Okay, you said Tejada.
Did I say Tejada?
Yeah,
you say Tejera. I say Tejada.
I say Tejera. So here's what happens when you have a bad team. You bring up people who you know are marginal players, and you hope that you catch lightning in a bottle, and you bring them up because you have no one else at all to possibly bring up. But you do it knowing that you have a problem. And that's what many of these players were. But with Volstadt, it's different. Volstadt was a high draft pick, don't forget. Volstead had a great big body. He was like 6'7". He had an arm angle where you could hide the ball, and it didn't work. By the way, we had a draft in 05. We had all these great picks. We drafted all these pitchers at the top of the draft, and they all stunk. God, why are you making me talk about that?
Well, I feel like there's more meat on this Chris Volstead.
Yes,
bone.
Where's the Volstead story you were going to tell?
The Volstead story is that he was one of the players who had one of the, and he's a good guy. Please don't get me wrong. And he actually had a good career.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Not as good as I wanted him to.
Oh, this is going to be good.
But he's a player, and there's many of these, and there's many executives like this, and many radio hosts and podcast hosts who have a delusional thought about what their skill is and what their ceiling is.
Thank you.
And when players have that, what happens is they don't know how to deal with their own failures, because they're not willing to grow from them. They're not willing to listen to them. And that's what happened with many of our players and many players in the big leagues. You know, Jeff Conine taught me something that we should teach. Being the best physical specimen and the best physical tool guy in baseball or in any sport guarantees you nothing. Because if you're empty between the ears, you are not going to be a professional baseball player.
Word association, when I just say to you, first name that comes to mind, the Marlin who was most delusional in that particular respect, where they just had an outsized lack of either self-awareness or confidence that was unearned.
A guy I'm still in touch with, Jeremy Hermita.
You knew it. Mike just shouted, and he did like Tiger Woods winning at the Masters, doing a fist pump because he was so happy. He mouthed Jeremy Hermita because he was a five-tool player.
How did you know I was going to say that?
Because he had it all, and I hung out with him once, and he carried himself like he knew that he was going places. And I'm sure he actually had a really difficult time coming to grips with the fact that his career didn't pan out. It was so easy for him. Everything, even his first at bat in the majors, which I was there for. I went out and bought tickets because I was like, Hermita is going to be headed to the Hall of Fame. This is a can't miss prospect. First at bat, grand slam. Holy shit, we got a generational player. And then it just doesn't
Such
work out for the kid.
Such a pretty swing. Whittingham, put it on the poll. Who carried themselves with arrogance that was undeserved, like they were going places more during that time period? Was it Jeremy Hermita or Mike Ryan? Which of the two carried themselves more with that attitude? You and him must have been like crushing the town.
The automatic slims with Ugla, with ripped up jeans and flip flops after a few heaters at Tarpon Bend. Man, what a time. Hermita would rock the affliction shirts.
Do you remember Hermita's first at bat, by the way?
I just detailed it.
Do you remember what happened after? Do you remember how that whole thing happened?
I drank a lot of beers.
Hermita was our top prospect. He had the sweetest lefty stroke.
Oh, yeah.
He was a can't-miss guy.
Couldn't miss.
Can't miss. He played with a pulse rate of 30. And I've talked to him about this. That's just how he's wired. He showed no emotion on the field. He looked like he didn't care. He looked like he didn't like baseball. And it used to drive us absolutely crazy. We would ask him to please, we're begging you, show something. Get into a fight with somebody. We were like, just punch someone in the clubhouse.
You guys
do
were,
anything.
Wait.
And after he hit the grand slam, the view was to the moon. It's as though he had bought AMC, right? That was the feeling. And guess what? Didn't quite work.
You guys were body language guys. You wanted him to run hard to first like David Eckstein?
We are very much body language guys. That's actually how we would decide to send players down. The fans and the media would call for us to make moves way before we wanted to make them, because we didn't focus on whether someone was 0-for-20. We would focus on what they would do after they'd make out. Their body language.
Wait a second. You were body language guys, but on the other hand, you're buying Hanley Ramirez a necklace. His body language must have driven you crazy.
Hold on. Hanley Ramirez, there's some players. Hanley Ramirez never had the I don't care body language. He had the I don't necessarily like baseball language. He had the I don't want to be a good teammate language. He had the I want to be Manny Ramirez, so I better bulk up my body by doing whatever it is I did to bulk up my body language. He had the you better sign me to a long-term deal because you have a new ballpark, and then I'm going to play like crap in the first season of the ballpark on purpose body language. Well. He had the I don't really care to be a good teammate, and I'm not going to go after a ball and play hard language. Hmm. But he did not have the sort of dead Hermita language.
I didn't know that there were all these sorts of branches on the bad body language tree, but Tommy Hutton was basically encapsulizing all of that body language into just bad body language nightly for you guys on television.
He's a the language tree is like 1,000 branches. And so I would often talk to fans. We would give away sometimes for charity. We'd let fans come watch games with us for an inning or 2 innings or 3 innings, or talk to people not in the game who thought they could do our jobs better than we could, and many times they could. But we would watch baseball games way differently than you would, Mikey. We're watching for way different things. We are paying attention to little nuances of the game, positions of players, what they're doing when the ball's not hit to them, whether or not they're literally playing the game the way we have asked them to play, what they're doing in the clubhouse, how they're reacting to players when the cameras aren't on. So we're paying attention to all that stuff.
I'm not exactly 100% sure of the timeline, but the Tommy Hutton thing was very controversial. Marlins fans love Tommy Hutton. I don't think Jeffrey Loria liked him. Can you explain to me the whole Tommy Hutton controversy?
Enough for the Tommy Hutton thing.
Why?
First of all,
I have never asked you.
The narrative of Tommy Hutton is that he was a Hall of Fame color. What's it called?
Your commentator. Play by
color commentator.
Yeah.
Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Greatest of all time.
Right. Like Dave Van Horn.
He got you. Like the Hall of Famer, Dave Van Horn. That's right. He got
so,
you.
I got Let me you. Tell you about
admit
God
it right
Van
now.
Horn.
He was doing broadcast remotely. I heard a phone ring one time.
He got you.
Admit it.
Dave Van Horn is a Hall of Famer. He was a Hall of Famer. He is just past his prime. The problem with Dave Van Horn is he just got older. It happens. Father Time is undefeated, and it's hard on radio when it's a short fly ball to the second baseman.
Tell Tom Brady that.
Home run.
Tell Tom Brady that. Father Time is losing.
No, Father Time will beat Tom Brady.
Okay.
If Tom Brady gets an extension from the Buccaneers,
they're going to give him an extension.
Then you know that there's whatever.
I know what you guys were trying. We'll get back to Tommy, but I know what you guys were doing with DVH. DVH, you always brought in the young blood, Roxy Bernstein, Jesse Agler, who was, I thought, very good. You would always try to spruce up the radio commentary because I think you guys were keenly aware of what had happened at DVH. You said he was a little past his prime. I think he was scores of years beyond his prime.
I love the idea of bringing in the young hottie, Roxy Bernstein.
It was such a great name. No way that was his real name.
That was his real name.
What?
And then it was Glenn Geffner.
Ooh, Geffner.
Who's really good. But Dave Van Horn, listen, how do you deal with an aging superstar? How do you deal with an aging superstar?
Minor league contract.
Well, in the case of Tommy Hutton, you fire him.
So let me just explain what happened with Tommy Hutton so we can end this once and for all. Guess who paid Tommy Hutton? Just guess.
Fox?
Jeffrey?
Fox?
Good guess. Fox.
Okay.
Not Jeffrey. Guess who has hiring and firing of the TV analyst and play-by-play guy?
This is convenient.
Are you alleging? I have not heard this.
Not
are you
alleging.
Are you?
This is not an alleging, Lebatard. This is an actual. Do we have consultation rights? Yes, we do. Do we have the right to say we would not mind a change? Yes, we do. Do we have the final say of whether a change is made? No, we don't.
Was it
the
done?
The reason Tommy Hutton was let go is he asked for a raise on a per game basis along with doing fewer games.
Was it with your objection that he was let go in any way, or did you nod and allow for an assassination?
I did more than nod.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what I did. I don't want to celebrate. Listen, Tommy Hutton, we had a problem with Tommy. The problem with Tommy was that he had an issue with a lot of the players in the clubhouse. And I was not old in my career where I was able to fully, properly navigate those issues. And in a relationship with players where I'm trying to do what's right for the company and I can't give them too many victories, I can't give the players meaningful victories because I'm running a business, this was one that was an easy victory because it was it was greased by Fox because they wanted to move on. They didn't want to pay as much. And I knew that there was it would be a victory for me in the clubhouse quietly because after he was let go, of course, people are saying he's the greatest. Da, 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 da. But privately, that wasn't the case.
So players would come to the front office and complain about Tommy Hutton?
To me. You have to realize they watch. So the TVs in the clubhouse, I watch games on mute to this day. Because when I listen to many broadcasters, they do not necessarily add anything to the game that I can add. Or that I already know. So I will generally watch on mute. The players watch on full blast. They want to hear what every broadcaster for every team feed is saying about themselves. And then you get on the team plane and there's the guy who is saying that you loafed it. You didn't get the runner in. You didn't execute the play. It creates issues.
Did that happen on the team plane with Tommy Plenty?
A lot of things happened on the team plane with Tommy. I mean, it was... Listen, it's not comfortable. It's another reason why we don't have media on the team plane, except in emergencies like hurricane or you know things like that, because it's uncomfortable. There needs to be some separation, and it's really that line has blurred even more today. And what you would refer to it as would be a homer.
Well, it sounds like Tommy was too critical for everybody.
He was the anti-homer.
That it sounds like he'd get the red ass, he'd criticize somebody, and the players didn't like that. Well, let's go back to the philosophy you were talking about, though. When you say you can't give the players too many victories, explain to me why that is and explain to me some of the places where you had to wrestle with that, where you gave in and decided, okay, I'm going to give the players a victory here. Give us some examples.
An example is when I'd want players to do certain things in the community, and they would always balk because they don't have a lot of days off, they don't have a lot of time to themselves. And the reality is that what they would do is they would complain or not show up. And I would ask the players to do certain things that were meaningful to me. So I used selfishly certain community events for charities or certain appearances that either I was going to be at or that I thought were more worthy. They're all worthy. It's actually running a foundation was one of the hardest things I did as team president because you have to say no to so many worthy organizations. But I would let players say and win by saying, okay, don't show up. The game went long. I will be your talk piece to the Community Foundation Department, to the Community Affairs Department, and you can skip that. I would talk to the manager or to Jeffrey about certain rules of travel, certain rules of facial hair, certain rules of when there was going to be pee or what time the players need to report after a long game. I tried to do things like that because I knew those were penny ante things. And not working in the community. I don't want to say that those charities are penny ante. Those are penny ante financial things for me when I'm responsible for the big business in general.
Circling back one last thing on the Tommy Hutton front, and you got kind of emotional about it, which I like. And part of the reason why you got emotional about it was this was a very unpopular move with the fan base. People really appreciated Tommy Hutton's candor and honesty. Did you guys underestimate his popularity with the fan base, or did you know that it was going to be a bad public relations situation for you guys?
Isn't there a third choice? You have to give me a C.
Okay.
What would C be, knowing me the way you know me? I don't want to set you up. We don't rehearse. We didn't even start the show yet. C. I don't care.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about the public relations. He never cares.
Literally.
Have you ever? Has there been an instance when it did? Has there been an instance I guess Ozzy a little bit. That's a good one.
Hold on. That is a great one to talk about. And we can go third rail on this.
Well, we've talked about it some, but I don't think Dan has explored the spaces. So, Dan, why don't you get in there with the Ozzy Guillen stuff?
Well, it's fascinating. For those who do not know, okay, the backstory is this. It was a bit stunning that the Marlins hired this guy in the first place because the idea of, and Ozzy Guillen had won a championship with the Chicago White Sox. People didn't think that was a possible thing. He went from very popular player, outspoken, fun, flamboyant, fluorescent, to manager who would say anything. I'm not even sure we've ever had someone like that in a baseball dugout leading a team before. I don't think, maybe we have, but top of the food chain in terms of we'll just say anything and not responsible in terms of professionalism or anything else. They've got to open a ballpark. They're trying to be splashy. They've hired a name manager. It's well outside of what they normally do. They go outside of their entire principal base when it comes to leadership because they've always treated managers as middle management, but they go and hire a star, and he begins the proceedings in the center of Calle Ocho in Little Havana, in the center of all things Cuban in Miami. We're going to open a ballpark with the one thing that the guy, almost literally the one thing you cannot say to this fan base, this customer base, where he goes off and says, you know, Castro wasn't all that bad in some places.
And believe it or not, it actually wasn't that surprising of an opinion from him. It was just that he had the balls to say it publicly.
And he had gotten way too comfortable with I can say anything and yeah. No, you can't.
Yeah, I don't know. This wasn't exactly pre-internet. You kind of knew what his political stance was. Did this not come up
in meetings? No, that part, they didn't see that part. And that's where they get hurt by not having a Cuban at the top of the organization.
Or Venezuelan, because it was pretty obvious which side of things he was falling on.
Dan, if you think that we were going to hire a Cuban at the top of the organization on the small chance that there'd be somebody who would come in and say what he said about Castro, you're just wrong.
I'm saying that's the first thing I was taught when I got to Miami. That's why some things are important when it comes to diversity, because you need somebody else in your ear sometimes that have a perspective that perhaps you don't know about, or perhaps you have a blind spot about.
Yeah, so we were incredibly diverse, and I had... that was what I was going to tell you about the Ozzie Guillen Castro situation, is that I knew that was the third rail in Miami, because I was taught that literally the first day I came in, and the first meeting I ever had was about what you cannot say about Fidel Castro. And you have to learn and understand what's going on in this community, in the Miami community.
But I don't think you guys fully did, because his stance on Hugo Chavez was pretty known.
Yes, that is true, except in baseball circles and in my advisory circles, I was told that his stance on Venezuela is not the type of third rail that it is on Castro. Dan, do you disagree with that?
Say that again, because I don't know that there's a third rail in Miami that can be what Fidel Castro is. When we're talking about the single worst thing that you could say to this customer base, if you want to get on the wrong side of things, you have seen the way that Cubans in Miami go politically as it comes to the state of Florida. It is the rare minority community that has a legitimate power in Miami.
And I apologize for interrupting your thought. My whole thing was always with Ozzie Guillen. He was pretty publicly a supporter of Hugo Chavez. So it's not about having like a Cuban in a front office saying, hey, he may be pro-Castro. It's what about, forget what's going to happen in the future, what about what he's already done? Because there was a big Venezuelan community down here in South Florida at the time. And while Hugo Chavez wasn't considered Fidel Castro, he was very strongly aligned with Fidel Castro. Certainly, this was within the realm of possibility. I'm surprised it was never brought up.
It was definitely, wait, hold on. It was definitely brought up, but it was dismissed by my advisors who are Cuban, you know their names, or I don't know.
Well, Tony Perez is the highest ranking. Wasn't he the highest ranking Cuban in the organization?
No. Not in terms of policy making. In terms of baseball, yes, but not in terms of policy making, in terms of who's in my ear advising me on these matters. I don't think I spoke to Tony about Cuba at all until after the Guillen incident, as a matter of fact, where I wanted to make sure that he would be on board and be helpful to us in trying to see if we could reclaim Ozzie. He just didn't want to do anything on screen because we were being filmed for the franchise that year. So this was all going on. There was such another layer of this. My first reaction when I was told what Ozzie said.
Let me just tell the audience. The franchise was a Showtime reality show 1 year about the Marlins. They allowed the cameras in the clubhouse. Go ahead. I'm sorry, David.
It was like Hard Knocks for baseball. And we were the last team to do it because after that, the franchise went out of business because the union and the players said never again. And the owners said no chance they'll ever do that again. I thought it was great, compelling TV because it actually happened. So much stuff happened during the course of that 2012 year. But in any case, so Ozzie Guillen says this, I get called in the middle of a Seder. I'm leading a Seder and it literally is the night of Passover. I get called about the article. I excuse myself because I know balls need to be made now. Here's where I had the blind spot of being white and privileged. I actually thought my initial reaction was that while this is bad and this is what is never supposed to happen, can we navigate out of it because he's Venezuelan? And I was told that night that there was no navigating, but there were 10 steps we were going to take. He was going to meet with the, I'm going to absolutely embarrass myself. And don't take this as me being I'm not anything. Is it the nuns who wear white are called something?
Oh, I should. Oh,
if
I know
you don't
this.
Know, then yes. That's really
no, but bad. I should know this. And now this is embarrassing to me. Now you, last
way more for you.
They're like, oh man,
I've it's heard a famous.
This. No, I've heard this throughout my childhood. Like this is now you've really embarrassed me. It's not like Caridad. What? Oh my God. Las monjas, las en blanca. I don't. Oh man.
Okay.
Okay. This is a real suffering right here.
They'll edit that out because Mike. Will
no, we'll leave it all in. We'll leave it all in, and I will appear like un cubano arrepentido because my Cuban history. I should absolutely know this. I've literally heard it across the decades. I just haven't heard it in a decade.
So that was the first group who Ozzy had to meet with, and they came to the ballpark and met with Ozzy because Ozzy was going to go on the apology tour and the explanation tour. But what I don't recall telling Ozzy, and what I know is true, is that we knew that day that he would have to be fired. Because I was told by my advisors that no matter what apology tour he goes on, it will never be enough to make up for what he said, and it will be a stain on the organization. So while we put him on the tour, while we had him meet with constituencies, it was never going to be enough to save his job.
Can you sort of take us through the initial response from Ozzy when you guys come in? And it was Time Magazine, right?
It was a much longer article. I don't remember what magazine. He said, "I respect Fidel Castro," was one of his quotes. I can't imitate Ozzy. I didn't say anything like that. I don't feel that. I know that Castro is a bad guy, but I have my right to say whatever. He was militant about his right of free speech and his right to say what he wanted and him not thinking their consequences. You want me to say I'm sorry? I'll say I'm sorry to anyone. You just give me a list of people. I'll call them. Like, he was insane about it, trying to protect his rights. And then his wife ended up being hugely helpful to us by explaining to him how bad it was. And he had two kids who we had to hire when he was hired to work for the team. They were helpful as well in this regard. And we started the process of trying to heal the market, which was so broken by things I had done over the past decade, and then Henry and Heising and everything else. But that was a bad day. That was a bad day, Levitard, because that's when I knew for sure that our ballpark and our opening year was going to be a problem. Not that Hanley and Jose didn't get along, not that we didn't have a good enough team, not that we lost game one against the Cardinals with Josh Johnson pitching, none of that. Not that we couldn't sell out the Red Sox that season in a brand new ballpark, none of that. Not that we were over budget and underperforming. It was that everything we had planned for and dreamt about, and all the tampering we did to hire Ozzie Guillen. We traded the White Sox a player to get him, even when Jerry Reinsdorf wanted to get rid of him. Baseball Bud Selig called me and said, "Don't hire Ozzie Guillen. It's going to be a mistake." Jerry Reinsdorf told me it's going to be a mistake, even though he wanted to not have him. And I had no choice. We brought in Ozzie, and it was a terrible, terrible thing that happened. And it set the franchise back. And frankly, it is why the franchise is where it is today, in large part because we screwed up 2012 so badly in every way on and off the field.
I have so many questions here. You just sort of skipped past something I had not heard before. Hanley Ramirez and Jose Reyes didn't get along?
No.
What was the backstory there?
We pretended they did on the franchise. We had them play video games together. I don't know if you ever saw the franchise, them playing video games in a bedroom.
You stored it? You staged it?
They wanted players doing stuff at spring training homes. Go back and watch the franchise. Now, keep in mind what we did on the franchise. We did not do second takes of anything, which other teams do in Hard Knocks and in the franchise previous incarnations. We would say to the cameraman, just be around because shit just happens around us all the time. But when they're doing B-roll or where they're doing sort of a piece, they will not stage it. They'll say, "Hey, we want you guys to be in your spring training home and show us what it's like." They get together and play video games.
Did they get to, and that's fascinating that you would use the franchise as a propaganda arm, though it makes sense given
it
that
was
it's
so
a show.
Smart, Mike, yeah. It was so smart. I know we've talked about it here, but what David was trying to do is so smart and it ran against everything in baseball. Like There's no place more resistant to that kind of smart.
And he was the only one that enjoyed it.
No, the whole thing's great, though, because he's understanding, hey, this is all entertainment. This will be fascinating to use our commodities to get our like, imagine what a great marketing tool to have an interesting show as you head into that season that makes the Marlins more popular.
It was all that. Yeah. That's why we went over budget to bring in Reyes and Burley and Bell. That's why we agreed and wanted to do the franchise so badly. Everything was trying to make 2012 as an explosion. And by the way, what happens if we had won that year? Not the World Series, but just 90 games and made it to the playoffs.
What happens if you simply don't sign Heath Bell and get someone who's not fat and is competent?
Heath Bell was so good the year before.
Yep.
And we were told that Heath Bell was a good guy. The problem is we were told that by agents who would say anything to get their player signed.
David.
And I had an inkling that we had a problem when Heath Bell didn't even want to see Miami or talk to any of us before he accepted the deal. I said, we may be overpaying him.
I can't believe the number of things that you guys did that year that were out of character, because you've got the Ozzie Guillen signing, and you just talked about we had to hire his two sons. Like, what are you agreeing to here? We had to hire his two sons. Start there, because you just said a number of things I want to ask you about.
Start where? Why? What are you talking about?
Why did you hire his two sons? Like, what?
Why did we hire Jeff Torborg's son to be our strength and conditioning coach when he took over for the fire Felipe Lu? Did we have to hire his other son and do arbitration with his other son, Greg Torborg? Why did we have to bring in Ozzie's sons? Why do we have to have Joe Girardi bring in Bobby Meacham and Gary Tuck and all the other? Why? Because when you have no leverage, when you're told from above that this hiring is going to happen, and the people who you're hiring know that it's not a negotiation, you're being hired. When I walk into a negotiation with Ozzie Guillen and I say, hey, listen, let's talk about a 2 to 3 year deal. What you talking about? He said, it's a 4 year deal at $2.5 million a year. It's done. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I got a deal.
And so but wait, the two kids, the reason I objected that way, and you mentioned the demon, and I know that you guys have covered the demon, the wrestling character.
He wanted them brought in. He wanted them around. He wanted them to have a position. He wanted them to be in the game.
I know, but last week we talked to you about Ichiro and the translator, and you were saying to Ichiro, to bleeping Ichiro, hey, you pay for your translator. So if you're doing that Ichiro, why are you
me in the Kevin Mather category? What we said to his agent while we were negotiating is we think that we will pay the interpreter the per diem. We'll bring him on the road. He can be on the team plane. But is it really unreasonable for Ichiro to pay his salary? The agent said, yes, he won't do it. And we said, are you sure? Back and forth. And we paid the interpreter, who happens to be someone I still am in touch with. So don't say what you said before trying to lap me in with Mather. I'll do it myself if I want to be lapped in with him. I'm not going to let you lead me there.
The other thing that you guys did that was incredibly out of character that year is you guys never pay for relievers. You guys, in the history of this franchise, you just move through relievers. You go, it's Alfonseca 1 year. You guys don't give the big contract to a reliever. And you gave a bunch of long-term contracts in general. And on top of that, you chase Pujols all around the earth. He's making $30 million this year. This year, Pujols is still making $30 million.
His final season, he's walking away from the game next year.
So here's a funny Pujols story is that when we were negotiating with him in 2012 in the winter meetings, which were in December of 2011, his agent was a guy named Dan Lozano. And we were told that he wants a long-term deal. We were told that he did not want to be in Miami because his wife didn't want him in Miami for all the distractions that exist here. And so we offered him an obscene amount of money, over $200 million. And that was enough to get it done, we thought. And we knew when we did the calculation for that deal that we didn't care about 2019, 20, or 21. It was so far in the future that it didn't matter. We knew he'd be unproductive. We knew that he was not the age that he said he was. We had all the information. And what's funny is now here we are in 2021. And you see how it played out for the Angels. And the Angels can say what they want, but they are despondent with the Pujols contract.
There's so many paths that we have to go down.
I want to ask him a million questions. Did you just report flatly that Pujols is older than he's always claimed to be?
We always alluded to that.
We assumed
there
it.
There is not one person in baseball, not one executive, who believes that Albert Pujols is the age that he says he is. the amount of fraud that was going on in the Dominican back in the day, the changing of names, the changing of birthdays, it would blow your mind. It would literally blow your mind.
And you guys actually got burned by that with the Leo Nunez situation.
Burned.
Yeah, you've covered that. Real quick, because I got to go back. I have it in my notes. What was the seeds of the bad relationship between Hanley and Jose Reyes? Was this just oil and water personalities didn't match, or did it harken back to position?
Yeah, it was my fault. So I was on a cultural exchange club trip, and that's a group of guys. We go to a different sporting event every year since 2006, the same four guys, except we couldn't go last year because of COVID. And we were on a trip. I think it was the World Polo Championships in Buenos Aires, which I'm sure I said wrong. And I got a call from Hanley because I wanted to tell him that we were looking at signing Reyes. And he said he wants to play shortstop. And I said, Hanley, are you going to be okay playing third in the new ballpark? You've got your long-term deal. Everything's great. And Hanley said to me, and I was at a dinner, he said, we're fine. I will be your third baseman. Let's go win. Okay, Samson? That's what he would call me. Call me Samson. We're okay, Samson. And I convinced myself that we were okay. And we never were okay. Just like we wouldn't let Hanley. Do you know that he didn't want to be in the same BP group as Giancarlo Stanton when Giancarlo Stanton came up to the league?
Who would?
That's a great story, though. I imagine nobody wants to be in that.
He would demand to be in a different group because he did not want to be showed up by Stanton's BP.
That's such a good story. Can you give us a real glimpse at you in real time as you watch your owner buy Hanley Ramirez that piece of jewelry that he hung around his neck like a woman that he was wooing, like a wife on an anniversary? You made
3-4-2.
Yes, the batting average that led the league. I want to know where you were when it was bought. I want to know all the details about that necklace in terms of how you experienced it.
So I learned working for Jeffrey for 18 years that you have to, like the players, you have to give small victories. You have to choose what you are going to stand on principle, what you are going to resign over and what you are not. Jeffrey wanted to do nice things for the players. I get it. He wanted the players to like him. I get it. He didn't want to ever be the bearer of bad news. I get it. It turns out Hanley loved that necklace. I thought it was gaudy and ridiculous. He loved it. And he did something for Anibal Sanchez after Sanchez's no hitter. He made a big pendant for Anibal Sanchez. So he loved doing little things like that. He bought Jack McKean a car. Like, he just does little things to make people believe what they want to believe about him.
You gave us a lot of great stuff this episode. You did something you rarely do, and we never discussed what's going to happen before. I wonder if it was born out of a text convo that you had with Dan. But you teased the closest you ever came to actually quitting your job. I would love to get that story. Let's get it next week, because in this episode, we've already gone long and Roy Bellamy's got some Panther talk to Sable at the end. Let's get your review, and I promise you we will discuss the closest you ever came to actually quitting your job next week. That'll be next week's episode, but let's please get to your review this week.
So as everybody knows from Nothing Personal, and thank you, by the way, for downloading, subscribing, and joining that podcast, I watch a movie every single day, and I watched, at the request of a listener of Nothing Personal, a 40-minute documentary called Long Shot on Netflix. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it is the most bizarre documentary about a guy charged with murder. And he's about to go to trial. He's about to get the death penalty. And he claims he didn't do it. And some lawyer said, you know what? I'll take the case because I believe your voice sounds good. His claim was, his alibi is, he was at a Dodgers game. So he searched all the cameras trying to find the guy at the Dodger game. And the only reason he was found at the Dodger game is Curb Your Enthusiasm was filming the exact day that this guy was claiming to have not committed a murder. And they chose to shoot the film exactly where the episode,
That's where this guy was sitting. That is great.
It is the longest of shots. It's a great 40-minute documentary. It is worth your time because it is scary. It is scary how, if you are a person of color, where you can be accused of something from a lineup that's fixed, and you could go to jail or be killed. And this is not being liberal or being conservative. It is outright scary when your only alibi is a relative who is incentivized to lie for you, and you manage to get out of your basically you're being accused of murder because you were with Larry David on the Curb Your Enthusiasm set, and the set was a bunch of unknowing fans at a Dodgers game.
It's a great story. It really is. David, we will talk to you again next week. Also put on the list, Mike, because I want to get David's second place finisher to Scott Boras. He mentioned Dan Lozano, Albert Pujols' agent, and I just sort of had like something like a cold wind blow through me because the agent business is gross, and I want to get his second grossest agent. I want to know who classifies. Dave, that was really strong. Thank you, buddy.
Take care, guys. Thank you.
Hey, it's Mike Ryan, and I've been watching sports for a long time now. As an adult, a lot has changed. A lot has changed since I turned 21 in the world, but once I was able to enjoy sports with the wonderful taste of Miller Lite, I knew that there was no topping this. I mean, I think back then, instant replay was barely used in other sports outside of football. So when I wanted to complain about referees, I would get all mad, and then I would take a sip of that Miller Lite, cool myself down, take a beat, and realize there are more important things, like the great taste of Miller Lite. Less filling and only 96 calories, the original light beer since 1975. You remember all those old John Madden ads? I still view them on YouTube occasionally. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
My name is Roy Bellamy. I'm joined by David Dwork of Local 10. He covers the Florida Panthers here locally. And we are a quarter into the NHL season with the Panthers leading the division as of February 22nd following their win versus the Dallas Stars. Now, this has been a 56-game shortened season, so it's been very weird. The Panthers are in a new division possibly just for this year because all the Canadian teams are unable to travel outside of the country due to COVID. So it's going to be a very interesting process when it comes to figuring out who's going to make the playoffs. That's going to be very interesting. As I said, the Florida Panthers are in first place currently as of February 22nd following a win versus Dallas in the Discover Card Central Division. So let's turn to David here. How are the Panthers doing at the quarter of the way in?
Pretty awesome. I mean, you know, even the most optimistic outlook wouldn't have had them at, what is it, 12-3-2? So leading the temporary Central Division on top of Tampa, on top of Carolina, Columbus, it's great. And I mean, I'm sure Panther fans who've been, you know, long loyal to this team are just, you know, head over heels happy right now. And for me, I'm excited just because it looks like it's sustainable. It doesn't look like it's just a flash in the pan or a hot streak. Like, it looks like they're for real. So yeah, it's really exciting right now, Roy.
Well, Bill Zito's in his first year as Panthers general manager, he really seems to have made a major difference in the roster. Why don't you go over some of the moves that the Panthers made in the offseason, how these changes have really affected the Panthers on ice performance?
He's brought in, I mean, first off, the main two guys that I always think of that he brought in are Patrick Hornquist and Radko Gudas. Hornquist is a extremely feisty forward that's known for his just kind of sandpaper game. And this is all on top of the fact that he's been an amazingly consistent scorer throughout his career. And he's played on teams with guys like Crosby and Malkin, and he's still been able to maintain that scoring very consistently. He's been in the league, I think, 13 years. He comes to the Panthers. He adds that veteran element. He's won two Stanley Cups. He's performing these 15 points through 17 games. I think he's at 8 goals. Adding another element to their power play. So all these things in one little package. And then Radko Gudas, the defenseman I mentioned, he adds an element of grit to the Panthers that they haven't had since maybe the days of Erik Branson being around, where you are fearing this guy. You are always keeping an eye on him when he's on the ice. And he's another guy that's been around the block. He's a veteran. He knows how to win. He's been on winning teams before. And then just looking at the other guys that Zito brought in, whether you're talking about a Verhaeghe or a Wennberg or a Hinostroza or a Nutravara, professional guys. These are all guys that keep their head down, focus on winning. That's why I'm here today. I'm here to win. I'm here to be better today than I was yesterday. Just a lot of very professional players that he's brought in. And I mean, you're seeing how that's translated on the ice when this is, they're so consistent, right? They're coming to work every day and doing their job. Nobody's playing head over heels, amazing, having ridiculous seasons. Everybody's just doing what they're supposed to do, right? They're being consistent. And I think, as you said, Bill Zito, first year GM, you got to give him so much credit for this.
Well, you mentioned Verhage. You mentioned Hornquist. The first line with Barkov, Duclair, and Verhage, and the second line with Huberto and Winberg and Hornquist have done very well. What about the bottom six forwards? Panthers, depth scoring. How's that been for them this season?
It's coming on of late. It's nice that the depth you talk about, because guys that are in the bottom six, like you think about like a Frank Vetrano or perhaps a Brett Connolly, these are guys that were rotating in and out of the top six last year, and now they're just steady bottom six guys that are producing. The third line, centered by Eetu Luostarinen, who was brought over in the Trocheck trade from last year with Carolina, he's been a really nice find because of his two-way game and his ability to play on that third line with really, you know, the right wing spot has been moved around. You've seen Owen Tippett there. You've seen Brett Connolly move up there. Frank Vetrano has been pretty consistent on that line. Vetrano's having a great year, Roy. I'm sure you've noticed as well. He was known as a guy that was a speedy scoring type player. This year, his 200-foot game has gone to another level. He's playing great back checking in his own zone. He's on the PK a little bit this year. So just a continuing of a maturation process with Vetrano. And then that fourth line, amazingly consistent. Mainly it's been Nolichari. He's been injured for the last week or so, but even without Nolichari centering it with Juho Lammikko out there, you've got Ryan Lomberg, who's been pretty solid, big guy that can move well. On the other side, Hinostroza's there because you had Connolly moving up to the line, Tippett coming out. So there's been a lot of movement in that bottom six, but that kind of goes to your point, the depth. That's why they've been able to maintain, is because they can move guys in and out here or there, and the team's not really suffering any. Coach Chu often attributes that to the competition level at the bottom of the lineup. Guys are busting their ass and practice trying to get that game time. So it's really translating to better practices, to better games, to more consistent play. So, yeah, across the board, the depth has been huge this year.
And that's pretty good, because the fourth line isn't just for checking right now. They're actually going out there and providing a little bit of offense for the team. That's pretty good. Defensively, Keith Yandle came into the season possibly not being a Florida Panther. There was talk of him being shipped, and he's come in. He's got 2 goals. He's got 10 assists. He's still giving up bad turnovers, but he's been there providing a little bit of offense. But is there potentially still talk of him being moved, or is he going to stay for the season?
I think that chatter has really died down since the beginning of the year, when he wasn't really skating with the top unit. So there was talk about him possibly being scratched, the Ironman streak ending, which then opened up trade speculation. And why are you scratching a guy that makes this much money? It may have all been a whole lot about nothing, because he's played the entire season as he normally would. He's on the top power play, maybe not seeing the same amount of minutes that he has in past years because they don't need him in as high of a role defensively, not on special teams. And it also helps that Florida's been playing with the lead a lot more. So when you're protecting leads, you don't need to have Yandle out there trying to score for you. You can have your more defensive defenseman out there later in the game. So it all kind of ties into that. But at the end of the day, Keith Yandle is very good at doing what he's good at, which is being an offensive defenseman. And with that, you're going to take some of those defensive deficiencies. That's what everybody's known about Yandle throughout his career. That's what they knew about Yandle when they signed him. And that's what, you know, Coach Q and Bill Zito know about him now. So with Yandle, I mean, as you said, what has he got, like 12 points already in 17 games? Mm-hmm. One of the top scoring defensemen in the league while still not getting a ton of minutes. And his ability on the power play is second to none. He can quarterback a power play better than almost any defenseman in the league. Yeah, his contract is kind of heavy, but that, you, like you said, you get what you pay for. And right now, they're winning. They're scoring a lot of goals. Their power play is, I believe it's in the top five in the entire league right now, and he's a big part of that.
Speaking of getting what you pay for, let's talk about the Panthers goaltending situation. Sergei Bobrovsky is making $10 million a year.
Very subtle segue there.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm pretty heavy-handed just like that. That was a heavy hand right there. $10 million per year. Chris Drieger, the backup goaltender, has been playing better than Sergei Bobrovsky. They've had a strategy on playing the goaltenders. It's been 2-on-1-off for Bobrovsky early in the season. That seems to have changed now because of the way Drieger has been playing. So what's going on with the Panthers' goaltending situation? And will Bob live up to that $10 million a year contract before it runs out?
That's a great question. And, you know, we'll see how that works. As of now, it's not looking, again, it's early. So, you know, let's not count our chickens before they hatch. But I mean, right now, Chris Streeter is playing better hockey. He's been the Panthers' better goalie, and he's seen the majority of the starts right now. Coach Quenneville is never going to come out and say there's a goalie controversy. He's never going to throw one of his players under the bus. It's just not the kind of guy that he is. But at the end of the day, the better playing goalie is going to play more. And that's what we're seeing right now with Dreger. He started, I think, whatever it is, 3 or 4 out of 5. And he's starting the next game. But, you know, when you talk about the 2-on-1-off thing, that's more because of the schedule being the way it is, where there's been a lot of back-to-backs and the games are really starting to constrict with the time. So that's why whichever goalie's playing better, odds are they're both going to be needed. So even if Bob is struggling, he's still probably going to get, you know, at least 1 or 2 starts a week, assuming they both continue on this path that they're on right now. Dreger right now is the starter, you know, bottom line. If he's going to keep playing the way he's playing, he's going to keep getting the majority of the starts. And that's just the way it's going to be. The Panthers are winning. They're one of the best teams in the league. And Dreger has been playing like one of the best goalies in the league. Amazingly consistent. The team plays well in front of him. And that's just going to continue. They're going to keep giving Bob chances. And, you know, like I said, because of the schedule, he's going to keep getting his chances. And if he starts to reach that level where he's, you know, living up to that contract, all the better reason for the Panthers to have that kind of a goalie problem, to where you got two goalies playing great and there's no wrong answer with which one you start. But right now, one of them's playing better than the other. That one's playing more. And, you know, we'll just see how it goes. When the playoffs start and when it's one goalie, if the playoffs started tomorrow, it'd be Dreger.
Alexander Barkov, basically every season he's had, he's been a Selke Trophy candidate as best two-way forward. He has very good defensive skills. You think he's going to actually win the actual trophy this year?
I think a lot of that kind of goes hand in hand with how the team is doing. And being that the Panthers are one of the better teams in the league right now, they're going to get a lot more eyeballs on them as the year progresses. So there's a chance. Yeah. And Barkov is playing spectacularly this season. He's looking maybe like better than ever. You could say that about Barkey this year. Last year, it was kind of known but not known that he was playing hurt most of the season, and he did have a bit of a down year. Even though he still produced, just maybe not at the level that we were expecting of Barkov, is his, you know, he's still in his mid-20s. These guys are still getting better. So this year, he's really kind of appeared to take that next step. He's looking just amazing. Like when you watch this guy move through the neutral zone, it's like he can reach blue line to blue line. He's got such ridiculous reach and such a long stride. And you add to that the confidence that he's having, the kind of alpha mindset that he seems to have this year of shooting more than we've ever seen him. I mean, when he shot the puck at the empty net last night against the Stars, I was shocked. I was like, oh my God, Barkov actually shot an empty net. He wasn't looking for someone to pass it to. No, he got it on his backhand. His backhand, Roy.
His backhand.
Still ripped it into the empty net. So we're seeing a new Barkov this year. And if he puts up even better offensive numbers, which right now that's where he's trending, and he continues to be the defensive, amazing player that he is defensively, on a line, by the way, with a guy, Carter Verhaeghe, who I am so impressed with this guy defensively. This guy is like the Energizer Bunny on the ice. Mm. You watch him back check, you watch him reading plays in the defensive zone, it's really impressive. So you put these guys in a line together with another speedster and Anthony Duclair, it's been awesome to watch. And yeah, Barkov for Selke, I'm on board. The way things are going, I mean, Barkov for Huberto for Hart Trophy, Chris Dreger for Vezina, Coach for Jack Adams, Huberto for whatever the GM of the Year award is. I mean, let's do it. Let's just make it a smorgasbord.
Wow. The Hart Trophy, the Ted Lindsay Trophy, that's going to be an interesting race between him and Austin Matthews. Huberto and Austin Matthews, that's really going to be interesting. Well, I don't know if he's going to win.
Florida guy's never going to have a chance against a guy playing for a Canadian team.
No.
Not yet, anyway.
And not the best team in the league, Canadian team, with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I don't know. I don't know. So what's been the biggest surprise of the season? You mentioned Verhaeghe's defensive skills. I don't think anybody before the Panthers actually signed Verhaeghe thought that he was going to break out offensively like that. So what do you think the biggest surprise has been this season for Florida?
I think maybe how good Carter Verhaeghe is across the board, not just as – because we knew he could score. He led the AHL in scoring 2 years ago. So we knew that he had that kind of an ability. I had no idea what a great just all-around player he was, how fast he was, Like his first step, I mean, it's like Dwayne Wade on skates. His first step is so good. So that was kind of surprising. You know, when you get a guy like that for 2 years, $2 million, and then have him under team control after that, I mean, when are they building Bill Zito a statue outside the BB&T Center? Their defensive depth, I mean, honestly, I've been surprised. Like they signed, they picked up the two guys off waivers and Gustav Forsling and Noah Juulsen. And you're like, oh my God, they, you know, they pick them off waivers. So, you know, they got to be on the roster all year. And they already had a pretty steady, deep, stable in defenseman. And it's working. It's working really well. I'm surprised with how good Radko Gudas has been, how consistent. I didn't realize how good of a defender he was. He came in with this reputation as a kind of an ass kicker that might do something dumb every once in a while. And honestly, he was a player who I hated. I could not stand Radko Gudas for years, whether it was in Tampa, in Washington, in Philly, just did not like him. As soon as I saw that we signed him, I jumped out of my chair. I was so happy.
Because we've been missing that sort of toughness.
Yeah, no, for like a long time, everything that I hate about him is everything that the Panthers needed. And when you get all of that, and then we haven't gotten like the negative aspect of it. He hasn't done anything. He hasn't taken any big penalties. He hasn't put his team in a bad spot. It's just been awesome. So between Verhaeghe's just surprise, amazing 200 foot game, and Gudas is just all around smart play defensively. Yeah, that's probably my two biggest surprises.
Let's take a look at the prospects that we have so far, not only in the AHL, but in the junior leagues. What prospects do you see have a chance of making the big club coming up soon?
Well, talking about the AHL guys first, I mean, Aleksi Heponiemi did get a couple of games in before going back down and looked pretty solid. So you would think that he's got a role at some point. Sarah Noel is somebody who I'm definitely keeping an eye on. This kid's like 6'5". He's a huge power forward, but he can skate really well. Didn't see a whole lot of him during training camp, but he's skating in his first pro season. He was great in juniors in Ontario. And I'm really excited to kind of see him develop and come along as well. Chase Pristie, the defenseman, Riley Stillman, both guys. Riley Stillman just got called back up to the taxi squad, but Stillman looked really good during training camp. So I was a little surprised to see him get sent down. So I'd like to see how that continues. And Chase Pristie, the other guy who we got in the Vincent Trocheck trade last year, along with Luce Turainen, who I mentioned earlier, just another solid defenseman. So the Panthers have got some depth in that department. Beyond the AHL, I mean, there's the guy who we all talk about, Spencer Knight, the goalie, who's having another great year with Boston College. You would think that if he doesn't go pro after this year and he stays another year in Boston, I mean, either way, as soon as he goes pro, he's going to become the Panthers' AHL starting goalie probably for a season. And then, you know, we'll see what happens. It's kind of like when you look at the Panthers' goaltending from the top down, you know, you got Bob, who's not going anywhere for a while because of his contract. Dreeder, who's probably not going to be here after this year because he's an unrestricted free agent playing really well. He's going to have money thrown at him that the Panthers aren't going to match. Mm-hmm. Monsonbo would probably be your backup next year because he's still going to be relatively inexpensive and hopefully playing at a level, you know, coming up the way that the Dreeder did for them. I'm sure that's what they're hoping. And then after that would be Spencer Knight. So depending on how it shakes out year after year, that's your goalie of the future, Roy. And I mean, we've talked about it before. We've talked about watching Carter Hart and thinking, you know, this is what we could be seeing, or the young Russian goaltenders in the league, the Sorokins and the Shesterkins coming up. So it's quite exciting to have that much talent coming up in the Panthers' lower ranks. But particularly when you have a goalie like that, who's considered one of the top two or three prospects in the world, I mean, you got to love that.
Well, I'm with David Drake here from Local 10. He covers the Florida Panthers here in South Florida. Now, the NHL, because of COVID, has reformatted each division. All the Canadian teams are playing in Canada because they can't leave their country. So they got their own division. So the playoff format is confusing. There's no conferences. I don't even know if there's going to be a Prince of Wales Trophy or a Campbell Bowl this year.
That's a good question, actually. I mean, you would assume that the two finalists would get the two trophies, but which gets which?
That's a good question.
Eastern Conference teams in the finals or Western Conference teams in the finals?
That's a good question. And what leads to the third round is what? Like I don't know who's playing who.
Okay.
Outside of the division once we get to the second round. I heard it was going to be reseeded.
Yes.
And then whoever play, and then the two divisions, I guess, play each other after that.
Maybe? Well, yeah, the divisions would play the first two rounds in your division. So there's only, by the time we get out of the division, there's only going to be four teams left. There's going to be the four division playoff winners or whatever. So at that point, they would reseed based on the regular season. So, you know, if you're amazing in the regular season, you make it out, then you'll be the top seed in that final four. And then probably be more like March Madness final four, where they, you know, once they get reseeded, that's really going to be the bracket. That your question is actually really good. It's really kind of working my brain right now. Do they hand those trophies out this year? How do they, you know, how, and just think about how weird would it be if you get like Boston and Montreal in the finals, which yeah. you absolutely could.
Boston and Montreal in a cup final hasn't happened in what, 60? 60 yeah, years?
Original 6 days, right?
Yeah. Like that hasn't happened in a long time. That would be exciting. That would be an interesting matchup there too.
Well, that's kind of the cool aspect of the way the league is you're going to, everything this year is just going to be weird. Everything's going to be different. Kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, everybody just kind of knows that they're in it for whatever happens. Like they're in it for a season, you know, they're going to play hockey, they're getting their paychecks, they're able to continue their careers and, you know, whatever. Do we care that much? Like the Panthers, it's one of the craziest seasons we've ever had, but the Panthers are on top of the mountain right now. The only team in the league, I think, with better record than the Panthers is Toronto, who you mentioned the best team in the league. So do we care how crazy this season is? Do we give a crap about taxi squads and shortened schedules and threes in a rows? No. Those to be used as excuses if teams aren't doing well, but the team's doing well. So who cares? Like, yeah. You know, we've been following this team for so long to this point. Like, just let's just enjoy it.
I mean, you're right. Everybody's playing hockey. Everybody's getting paychecks. It's just everything around them doesn't make any sense. Nothing. Well,
that's true for most of us. It's not just the hockey guys. We're wearing masks out every day. We're having groceries delivered. I mean, you know, for the majority of people, it's been a crazy year. But most people still want to go to work every day. They got families to support. You know, hockey players are no different.
Right. You just adjust and you move on.
Yeah. You look, at the end of the day, they're professionals just like we're professionals. Under normal circumstances, you and I would be sitting across from each other right now, cheering scotch glasses instead of looking at each other through our Zoom computer screens. We adjust. We're professionals. It's what we do. And that's what everyone else is doing. I'm just grateful that we've got a hockey season and we've got our sports seasons. We got to see a World Series. We got to see a Super Bowl. I mean, there was a point last summer where we didn't have anything and we were all watching like Japanese baseball because it was the only sports on TV. So yeah. I'm very appreciative of what we have right now.
So how far do you think the Panthers will make here in the playoffs? It seems like, as you said, it's sustainable. And it's just been a surprising season. I thought that Chicago was going to be right there with Detroit. Looking at draft picks, that's not been the case. I thought Tampa was going to run away with everything. That hasn't been the case. I didn't even think about Toronto, and they're the best team in the league. And I wasn't even looking at the West teams. I was just thinking that maybe Colorado was going to make some noise there. So the Panthers, I mean, this has been a surprising season for everybody. And it looks like the Panthers might go further than the Marlins did during their season. So how far do you think the Panthers are going to end up going?
No, I mean, you know, like we said, it looks sustainable. So when the season started, maybe the first week or two, you're thinking, wow, is this real? Are they going to be a playoff team? And now here we are a few weeks later, and it's not, are they going to be a playoff team? It's, are they going to win this division? That's the question now. Like, as well as they're playing, and they proved it against Tampa three times, Carolina, they're playing last year's Stanley Cup finalists in Dallas very well. So it's not a question of, are they going to, you know, are they going to make the playoffs? At this point, if they don't make the playoffs, it's a huge, huge problem because of how good we can see them be on a game, on a week to week basis. So getting to the playoffs, now it becomes uncharted territory for the Panthers because it's not just trying to get in. Now there's expectations. It's not winning a playoff round is a big issue, especially if they're going to be one of the top ranked teams in the division playing a lesser team. I mean, we don't know how it's going to shake out. Right now, it looks like, you know, the Panthers, Tampa, and Carolina are kind of battling for those top spots. And while that might change, because you would think maybe a Columbus team or Chicago, who's surprisingly playing very well, are going to be competing for those that last playoff spot. But Yeah, I mean, if the Panthers are healthy going into the playoffs, they are built for a long playoff run. They've got scoring across the board, all four lines. They can roll them. They're tough. They're gritty. They've got guys that have won. They've got a lot of guys that have won. They've got one of the best clutch head coaches we've seen in the last three decades. Goaltending, I guess, would be a question because Dreeder's never been there before. And Bob, you know, I'm expecting probably Dreeder to be the starter. We've seen Bob now for a season and almost a half, a season and a third. Mm-hmm. And is he going to turn around? Maybe. It doesn't look like it's there right now. Something is off. He's not the guy he was when he won two Vezina trophies and was putting up ridiculous numbers in Columbus. So right now I'm kind of thinking Dreeder's going to be the guy. Is he going to be the guy to be in the playoffs? He could be. Mentally, he seems really strong. He's so chill. He's very honest when speaking to the media. Like, it doesn't seem like anything bothers him that much. And he just kind of goes through his progressions. He knows what his job is. When something goes wrong, he just breaks it down with the goalie coaches. He's just a very even keel goaltender, which maybe goalies are a little eccentric at times. But I mean, look, at the end of the day, if they're healthy and they're rolling into the playoffs like this, I'm almost a little frightened with what the expectations could be, because we haven't seen that. What, 96, 97 after they went to the finals was maybe the only time that there was any grand expectations surrounding the Panthers.
Right.
So, yeah, 100% uncharted territory. But the way that they are looking right now and the way that they've looked for, you know, whatever the season has been going on, 5-6 weeks, you know, let's roll, man. I'm ready to see how they can, how far it goes. They haven't won a playoff round in 20 some odd years already, you know? Let's do it.
Well, Bob missed training camp. I don't know if it was COVID. I don't know what happened there. If it was COVID, is that a major reason for his play so far this season?
We don't know for sure whether it was or it wasn't COVID. He kind of alluded sort of to it. But again, like, without anybody saying for sure, I certainly don't want to, you know, say that it was or it wasn't. It doesn't seem like whatever kept him out during training camp has hindered him. You know, with COVID type of situations, you wonder if it's like a respiratory thing, but it just seems like he's picked up where he left off last season. Like, that's basically what I'm seeing. And he's technically there. He works his butt off. He's one of the first guys on the ice. He's always putting in extra work with the goalie coach, Rob Talis. There's just something off. And I don't think whatever kept him out of training camp has anything to do with it. I think it's something that maybe was cropping up towards the end of his time in Columbus. Although when his time ended in Columbus, he had that great playoff run where they beat Tampa and they made it to the second round and Bob was playing amazing. So did something happen on the flight from Ohio to Florida? Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know what it is, but Bob, his rebound control lately hasn't been all that great. Normally you would just redirect that towards the corner or you'll be able to freeze the puck.
Yep.
That hasn't been great. He's overplayed some shots that once it does lead to a rebound that's not redirected to the corner or frozen, he can't get back in time. So I don't know what it is. Like,
I've wondered if it's something with his footwork. Like, as I've watched him this year, he kind of, if you watch Dreeder, he's quick, precise movements, just snapping his skates, tick, 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 cutting through. With Bob, it's, for lack of a better term, kind of wishy-washy. A lot of hip movement, his knees are moving a bit more, and it just doesn't, it looks like there's something a little off. He's making great saves. He's getting great pushes with his legs. I mean, as you mentioned, sometimes he over pushes, but he's not a huge goaltender. So that's a little, you know, fairly common among smaller guys. You think of, I mean, you know, not to get sidetracked, but like a guy like Jonathan Quick, not that big, but amazing control. Mm-hmm. Bob has been that way before. Now it's maybe a little bit more loosey goosey, but at the end of the day, the issue isn't really been so much with his legs and his knees as it is just giving up cheap goals. Now, whether that's a product of the funky movements or not, that's kind of what I'm maybe thinking as I watch him. But the rebound control is just, it's tough because when you're getting a rebound, the shot's coming at you 70, 80, 90, 100 miles per hour. So you don't really have much time. It's all about being in position before the puck is shot. So that way, all you have to do is make one or two quick little movements. You drop down into your butterfly, you get your hands up, and the puck goes where you tell it to. When you watch Chris Dreeder, pucks are going in the corner, pucks off his stick into the netting, or he just keeps it all in his belly. With Bob, there's so much extra movement that the puck is just kind of bouncing all over the place. It doesn't have anywhere to settle into him. It's not as big of a deal as it was last year, particularly because the defense is so much better at cleaning things up in between the circles this year. Last year was kind of a free-for-all in front of the Panthers' net. So, yeah, I can't put my finger on what the issue is with Bob, and I'm guessing they're having a hard time doing it on the Panthers' end too because the issues have not been resolved yet.
It seems like the Panthers have done a better job cleaning up quality shot opportunities from face-off circle to face-off circle and near the crease area as opposed to last season, which basically left Bob out to dry. And I think they've done a better job doing that as well. As far as the special teams is concerned, how do you think the Panthers are doing on the power play and the penalty kill?
Power play, one of the best in the league. Power play has been spectacular. I was curious how it was going to work this year because you lose two of your top power play guys from the last couple of years in Mike Hoffman and Evgeny Dadonov. And then you start a new power play with several new players, including a two defensive format instead of the last few years when they've been running four forwards. So there was a lot of changes. And so obviously it's going to raise a lot of questions, and it's worked tremendously. Aaron Ekblad as a second defenseman, as I put up my air quotes, he's not really playing a defenseman role on that power play. He's moving all over the ice. He's moving from the right side to the left side. We've seen him score a couple of power play goals from the left side, even though he's probably spent 90% of his power play time on the right side, which just kind of shows the flexibility this group has. Mm. And we talked about Patrick Hornquist earlier. His power play presence in front of that net, whether it's screening the goalies or getting goals himself, has been huge as well. So, yeah, they're not missing Mike Hoffman in that shot anymore. So the power play has been tremendous. The penalty kill, it's a work in progress, but when you've got so many great defensive players forward-wise, when you've got your Barkovs and your Acharis and your Lamikos, Alex Wenberg, Frank Vetrano has been playing very well, adding a little bit more to the penalty kill. And on top of that, you've got great defensemen already that have been playing it. The penalty kill should be okay. It's never easy because you're always going against the best players on the other team when you're defending a power play. I think as long as the Panthers' power play can continue to carry them offensively, it's going to be fun because you need good special teams to succeed in this league. And if your penalty kill is, average, middle of the road, and your power play is top five, it'll be okay.
So Yandel and Ekblad on the same power play line?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yandel and Ekblad have both been out there on power play one this year. But while Yandel is doing the more traditional defenseman quarterbacking role, Ekblad has been so mobile and so fluid on the power play that you won't really think of him as a defenseman. And Ekblad is so good in his offensive abilities that you're not really missing anything. Having him on that power play also allows you to have one of your top forwards that would have been on power play one. Now he can go to power play two and make that unit that much better. So, there's a lot of reasons why I could see why they went this route, and the fact that it's working, all the better.
All right. We're going to end our conversation on this. We are a quarter of the way into the season. Stanley Cup final matchup. Who do you got and who's winning?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I would love to see Toronto just because they're playing really well right now. That city is eat, sleep, breathe hockey. I think coming out of that North Division, whether it's Toronto or Edmonton, who they can score like the Dickens, and now they're getting better goal. Mike Smith, whether that's sustainable as their goaltender, I don't know. But one of those two teams I would suspect come out of the North and probably make it to the final. God, looking across the board, you got to look at Vegas as a potential cup contender. They're deep and they've got great goaltending, two great goaltenders, assuming they hang on to Fleury. And Florida's division, obviously you look at Tampa. Panthers are right there. And I'm naming, you asked me for finals teams, and I'm naming six teams, so I apologize for that.
Well, the playoffs is going to be a crapshoot as far as who's playing who anyway. So I guess this works out better.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be a playoff year unlike anything. And look, we had fun last year with the bubble and the play-in and all that. And it was fun having five or six hockey games on TV every day or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So, it's going to be a fun experience. But I don't want to not answer your question. So I'm going to say Toronto as one team and Tampa.
Toronto.
I, I just can't get past Andrei Vasilevsky. And Tampa's already good now. And then they're going to get Kucherov back for the playoffs. I'd love to see Florida take him down. Maybe they will. You know, certainly possible. But I'm not picking against Stamkos, Kucherov, Sorelli, Killorn, Hedman. Vasilevsky is just like a robo goalie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's my pick. I got it. Toronto, Tampa.
All right. David Drork, Local 10. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Roy. I'll see you in the press box.
Hey, it's Mike Ryan. I've been watching sports for a long time now. As an adult, a lot has changed. A lot has changed since I turned 21 in the world. But once I was able to enjoy sports with the wonderful taste of Miller Lite, I knew that there was no topping this. I mean, I think back then, instant replay was barely used in other sports outside of football. So when I wanted to complain about referees, I would get all mad, and then I would take a sip of that Miller Lite, cool myself down, take a beat, and realize there are more important things, like the great taste of Miller Lite. Less filling, and only 96 calories, the original light beer since 1975. You remember all those old John Madden ads? I still view them on YouTube occasionally. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.